Four groups, three questions. Britt, as a former mathematician, will be able to tell us how many permutations are possible on that, but we won't ask. We'll get right to the three questions that were put to our four groups. I want to apologize to the hearts group in advance, however, because I was operating from an earlier report that said we were to convene at 3:45, so I cut our group off early. So we were here on time, but in case, I think we did okay in the time we had. But we're going to take these three questions. We're going to try this process to begin with. We're going to take them one at a time, as opposed to having a full report from each group. And we're going to see what each group can add to the questions. And we're going to manage our clock, hopefully, so that we can get some additional comments, both from within the group leaders and others as time permits. Mathematically, specific recommendations. Do we have a group that will say that it has more than three recommendations? Peg?
To suggest that we didn't pay any attention to the questions, so
Peg's group has failed. We hate to, there's accountability here. We hate to say that, Peg, but
we sort of.
Oh, excuse me, Bob. All right. Well,
we were very creative.
Of the three other group leaders, do we have anyone who has three or more specific recommendations to question one?
More than three. We have one, but with many parts.
One with many parts.
Yeah.
All right, Britt, for that clever answer, we'll hear from you first.
Okay.
Here, then.
Well, we had a very good, we took our assignment very seriously, and we focused exactly on what we were being asked to do. And we interpreted question one, or issue one, as having basically two parts. How do you develop an agenda, a state agenda? What's the mechanism for developing it? And then secondly, once you've developed it, how do you go about implementing it in an effective way? Now, I want to make a caveat. I thought Jim Duderstadt made a very interesting point at the very start, because he used two counterpoints. One was California, which had as we all know, the master plan has this very top-down approach to the plan for California, and it obviously led to very good results. Michigan is, I think he called it Michigan anarchy. Everybody's got constitutional autonomy. There is no plan. There's no state coordinating board. And they let every flower bloom. And you know what? They've produced a pretty good system of, with a little less, of higher education. So, you know, there is a legitimate question here is about the existence of a formalized plan versus this more entrepreneurial approach. But I think, agreed that most states are going to want to develop in this day and age some sort of agenda for higher education. And we sort of thought that a good approach is one that has been followed both in Virginia and in the state of Maryland, where there is a formalized process that takes place on a periodic basis once every 5 or 6 years. I think it's 5 in Maryland and 6 in Virginia, where there is a broad-based group that called for by the state that includes business leaders, higher education leaders, elected officials, and a plan is developed that becomes sort of the state plan for higher education. And we think that I think the consensus was that this is a good approach, that it's broad-based, it brings in the business community. It's not owned only by the governor, and if we all know governors come, you know, and they go out of office, and you don't want to restart that every time there's a change in governor. So there ought to be some regular process for generating this plan. And we think that in good reason to think that in both Maryland and Virginia and other states that have tried this, that it can lead to a buy-in by state leaders that can have a very positive effect. The plan should be definitely embraced by the governor and the legislature. It ought to be a plan, in some sense, presented to them and that they buy into it. A well-constructed plan should make it possible for different institutions to respond to different aspects of the plan. We don't want every institution trying to become a research institution. We don't want every institution being an open access. The plan needs to be one where there are multiple ways in which institutions can respond to the plan. That once a plan is developed, it is very important that it be aligned with the budget and the accountability processes within the budget allocation and the processes in the state. One other thought, and then I'll stop. That it is important that we develop a process, and I'll come back to this in response to one of the other questions, that in the appointment of boards to the governing boards in a state, we need a mechanism whereby the governor can ensure that these appointees are aware of the plan, the overall vision, and where the state wants to head, and have the capacity to contribute to the successful implementation of the plan. It was our observation that so often you might have a state plan and then you have an appointment process for board members and ne'er the twain shall meet. They're just done on different tracks, and that in the appointment of board members, that there ought to be a conscious recognition of getting the talent that can address the issues that are in the plan.
Let's get into the other question.
Yeah, and I will hold off any further comment.
Very good. Take note that Britt has used the term plan quite frequently, and we have the term public agenda,
yes,
and state plan.
Yes.
Jim, that leads into our...
Most of what has been said, and I won't re-say that, but we spent a little time on plan and agenda. And we thought it would be better if it would be about the public agenda for the state, and that the strategic plans would probably be systems or institutions fitting into that plan. So we like the broader term of public agenda. We also, I believe, had some consensus that it'd be really good if the governor could be the chair of that commission on the public agenda, but it has to be very bipartisan. It would have to have a lot of legislative buy-in, and it would have to be done in a way so it didn't become a partisan issue, but it was about everybody. We agree that the political leaders, the public, hopefully the business community, and the institutions would be involved, because the bottom line is to create an environment where there was great ownership for the plan, because it would need support later on from the broader constituencies. We also thought that it might be good if the governor or whoever is giving the charge would be a little bit specific, so that we would deal with some of the tough issues like access, affordability, accountability, quality. It would deal with some of the tensions. We thought if the plan didn't deal, and this is basically on the papers and some of the presentations that all of you made, if it didn't deal with globalization, it wouldn't fit today. It would need to recognize that with this rapidly developing technology, the world is changing so quickly, and it would need to take into account that for most of our states, there's great diversity in an aging population. And above all, it needs to be aligning the higher education needs with the needs of the state. It needs to be very responsive to all of that. It should emerge with a strategic vision for the state, although maybe that's in the plan. And we thought, too, it shouldn't have 20 focuses. It maybe focus on the three or four top items, closing the gap, whatever that would be, so it didn't become too complicated. And then, and if it could be dealing with some of the issues that sometimes we don't deal with, that might be good, as long as you could keep the consensus. A little discussion, is this the public agenda, or does it include all institutions? If a system were doing it with a governing board, you might do that for your university system, the college system, but if the chief of staff to the governor for higher education is doing it, they've got to deal with everything, including the privates, and I think we came to the conclusion that it has to be the broad public agenda, although perhaps the publics would carry the greatest amount of the load.
Very good, Jim. I think both Britt and Jim have both added the word develop, Britt directly and Jim indirectly, to this question. It's not just a matter of implementing a public agenda. It's a matter of having one, developing one. All right, Peg, so you didn't follow the plan,
I can do this. Okay, so we talked first about what the state agenda is likely to be, and we started with the observation that economic development is on everybody's list, we tried to probe a little bit what that meant. We thought it included both worker training and research that leads to new product development and tech transfer of one sort or another. Then we talked about how do we broaden that to a much more capacious notion of the public good than is simply implied in economic development. And we decided that it will vary from state to state, but that one of the ways that you develop such an agenda is to try to find coalitions of people who have deep commitments to certain issues and work with them to develop goals and objectives around those commitments. That process can be led by a number of different entities or people. It can be a gubernatorial initiative. It can be a legislative initiative. But one of the dangers, of course, with both of those, and certainly this is true in Virginia, is the short-termer problem. SHIO agencies usually have longer terms, at least individual members do, but also over time they do. And so the question is, how does a SHIO agency then try to establish, and with the help of governors and legislators, establish, incentivize, I hate that word, but there's no other one, and measure progress towards statewide goals. In terms of establishing the goals, we said that strategic coalitions are probably key, both with business and sections of the economy, such as the historic connection between the land-grant institutions and the agricultural community, or the historic connection which is now being broken between teacher quality and teacher training colleges, which are now, because their missions are changing, they're not as committed to that connection as they used to be. We spent a lot of time talking about how do you provide incentives for institutions to actually get this work done. And the first one was, of course, money. And one of the things that we observed was that the federal government has, where there has been a deep level change at the level of DNA, as one of our members put it, usually it's involved very large sums of federal funding. GI Bill, land grant, you know, the Morrill Act, the big research funding after World War II. States don't have those kinds of resources. They can put some strategic funding towards paying for attention to public agenda, but they also have the resources of shame and approval, mostly coming through public reporting of outcomes. And then, so we got into the question of measurement. We thought it was very important to have a few simple metrics that captured key elements of the public agenda. We thought it's very useful to have a regression model that predicts performance on some measures so that you don't provide motivation for institutions, for instance, to increase their graduation rates by changing their or closing down access would be one example. We also thought it was important to have aggressive goals rather than simply trying to hit an average. So those were the things we discussed. Anybody from the group want to add anything to that?
We will see if there's any, just in a moment. I wanted to go, Britt, you had a comment.
Because in Jim's comment, he mentioned specifically the governor taking a lead in the development of the agenda or plan, whichever term we want to use. There was considerable pushback in my group from the idea that the governor should be the driver of this process to develop the agenda. Obviously, the governor has to be engaged, and it has to be has to take some ownership for the agenda in the plan or the plan. But the concern was that if it's the governor driving it, then every time there's a new governor, you know, you got to start all over with potentially with a new plan. So somehow getting this into the ongoing processes of the state that makes it happen on a kind of regular basis and engages the governor, but not necessarily driven by the governor. So that's just a nuance that came out of my group I wanted to mention.
I might just want to add that we agonized over that a little bit too, but we thought the power of the governor to lead it would be good, but most of all, we were interested in that person having the buy-in.
Right.
And so maybe if it were not appropriate for him to do it or he or she didn't care to, maybe to appoint somebody who would be highly recognized in the state. But we wanted the governor and the legislature to feel as though they were involved and own the project because we thought that was important for implementation in the future.
Well, certainly, certainly agree with the latter point.
Daryl,
let me jump in.
Okay.
Here.
Okay.
Since I am from New Jersey, I'm,
yes,
I'm just going to take control. Just one new idea I think that we can add. We started with my framework, not necessarily the brilliant individuals I work with, but the what, where, and the how, and sustainability I think was a big issue. I'll kind of really start with first we have to define the situation and what is higher education is connected to the broader public agenda, which many have talked about today, and define the issues that relate to workforce, economic development, participation of new institutions, new populations, mission differentiations, and so forth. But the one thing I haven't heard is to build as a metric that the governor is a key actor to lead, the CEO as an honest broker who helps to facilitate a statewide conversation and to aggregate and articulate interests broadly. But a big thing I thought that our group said was and the conversation's got to be sustainable. So there's got to be a mechanism built in from the beginning to sustain this, and we use the term public agenda, but to sustain it from beginning to end because actors will change, boards, governors, and other people. So the sustainability of it is a critical kind of front load front loading the outcomes and the means and the metrics. You have to know not only where you're headed, but how do you continue the conversation?
Just a couple things. Our group, when we talked about the roles, the leadership roles of the various possible actors, I think we concluded that the governor has the advantage of the bully pulpit and has that kind of moral authority and political authority to make an issue salient. The role of the legislature, we thought, was probably more in terms of insisting on regular reporting according to metrics that were easy to understand. And just the continual asking for evidence of results. And the SHEO agency was probably the one that was most able to sustain this kind of effort over time, as long as obviously there's some protection from the political process for the SHEO agency.
So we've added the words develop, implement, and sustain, I think, in this so far. Jim, did you have any comment you wanted to add on the sustainability? We had some.
I just would agree it needs to be a continuous process that continues to revise and get better. And if it can be on a 5-year term or something like that where it's looked at, I think that would be desirable.
We also thought sustainability would be helped by creating coalitions with constituent groups that really care about an issue. For instance, trying to find ways for the higher education system to create partnerships with, for instance, healthcare. Some of the entities that actually compete with us for funding could actually be, in some cases, collaborators with us on certain kinds of issues of importance to both groups. And healthcare would be an example. The need to train nurses is important to both higher education and business schools to help the business community in various ways.
Mark, you keep looking for the words, which is good. Accountability, I just want to be sure you wrote that down, that the accountability of the agenda, response to the agenda and the plan. I think one other thought is that this is a statewide agenda. There ought to be an expectation built in that every institution or every governing board in the state has a plan that aligns with the state agenda. And that should be an expectation in my mind of this process.
Very good. And I apologize. I may be overly influenced by something I heard a couple of days ago. I think it was Joseph Heschel, and he said that words create worlds and that words are important.
Absolutely.
And that the Holocaust didn't start with the building of crematoriums. It started with
the words.
Yeah. So, mindful of our time, is there any comment that anyone wants to come to the microphone and make before we go to question two? Yes, Gordon.
I did want to suggest that while we're talking regions, we need to be aware of the tremendous disparity within virtually every state of the situation on the ground in various regions. The south side of Virginia, for instance, the far southwest of Virginia, and the area right outside Washington, D.C., are remarkably different, all three of them, and they need different responses on the part of the institutions and on the part of the state.
I know in our group we got to that on question three, but we'll see how that plays. All right, Darrell, why don't you start question two?
Is what's two? How do we not mess up?
We had a lot of words, yeah, in that we diagrammed it in our group to strengthen governance and institution and system leadership.
Yeah. In effect, our group started with that. One of the issues, I can be very brief, there are four or five any critical points that colleagues made. Really wanted to start with number two, and some of our colleagues suggested that there's too many boards. And that with the system boards, campus boards, where we have mixed systems and SHIELDS and other boards. Andrea pointed out that we have development other boards, that there are just too many, and we might, working with governors and legislators and others, redefine the situation and perhaps not only get more collaboration, but look at fewer boards in some of our states. But there's some specific points that the group made is the appointment and engagement of board members, lay citizens, at all levels were critical to the whole integrity of our enterprise. That was very important. So that the one comment made was that we need to help our governors with more horizontal rather than vertical look at board appointments, which I took to mean a broader systemic view of how individuals come into these lay leadership positions, and perhaps even from out of our regions and states, from other places, and not just the vertical, typical kind of political, which comes through local up through the state system. Another specific recommendation was that we need explicit criteria, perhaps. In some cases, some states may need in statute, and others may come from policy principles articulated by the SHIO or others, but explicit criteria for selection, appointment, education development, and the continuing education of the board members beyond the institutional or system perspective that ties back into the whole public agenda metaphor. And a final thing that came up was, I think it was broad consensus, that we need to rekindle special emphasis for our board members on the sense of public good, and this whole idea of that, what we didn't use, but the whole purpose of the enterprise and the social contract and what lay people bring to the table beyond institutional advancement or system integration, the public good and public purpose of trusteeship, I think the group felt was very strongly needed to achieve the goals that they articulated.
The point about appointments, it might have been, Governor, you made this about how key a single appointment can sometimes be, or one or two appointments. Are states generally limited to appoint persons from in-state to boards, or is that the overwhelming practice to appoint persons from in-state to your boards? Overwhelming practice is my view, but But in most cases, it's not a statutory, or is it a?
I think in most cases.
Most cases it is.
A few exceptions.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Six states in the country that go outside the state. All right, Jim, why don't you follow up here?
I'd like to add a little bit. We started with some of what we read and thought about from your presentations, and that, I think we all know it, but the contemporary university or system is a very complex public corporation. It must be led, it must be governed, it must be managed with competence and accountability for the benefit of the stakeholders, and that leads then to the fact that people on this board must function with structure and a process that reflect the best positions of corporate boards. It's got to be comprised of members who have certain talent. And that led us to spend a lot of time on this subject. And so we discussed the fact that it would be really good if, as the governors make these appointments, if attention would be paid to what would be needed. And if there would be a little bit of the governor's staff would probably have to do it. What does this board need in terms of talent? Do they need accountants? Do they need people that are in strategic planning, that kind of benefit, and that was such an important part of success that a lot of time ought to be spent on what do we need and who could fill that. And then the process needs to be transparent. Apparently in some states they don't know how this happens. That's not the case in Minnesota. There's a procedure, sort of the AGB recommendation of a few years ago, but there needs to be a process by which people, good people, can maybe apply, other people can be recruited or nominated or whatever, and then if it has to be recommended by the governor, it needs to also, as it goes through the Senate or whatever it is, they need to feel good about that too. And then once you get this board member appointed, no matter how smart they are or how successful they've been, there needs to be respectful orientation about this enterprise. To get them up to speed about this organization, quite complex, that they're managing, and then a continued need, and you might have to call it something else, but what we call professional development and encouraging people to go to AGB, encouraging people to read, giving the kind of staff work. A very serious business if you're going to spend a couple days a month at this and do what needs to be done. So the right talent, the right fit, and then do all you can to have that person be prepared as well as possible. And then leadership we talked about too, because you don't want the board to do what they're not supposed to do. Leadership they're supposed to do, but leadership of the organization has to be important. And we talked about the academic leadership, for the most part, needs to come from the president or the chancellor. The advocacy of the organization comes from that organization with the help of the board. And then there has to be leaders on the other side have to be collaborative but decisive. And so you've got to have that blend of the board sort of knowing what they're doing and that kind of an outstanding leader. Bring that together and you go a long way toward accomplishing number two.
Very good. Peg?
I just would add that we didn't talk very much about board composition or structuring boards, but we did talk about the need to make sure that the leadership isn't just coming from the board, that presidents, for instance, are involved in whatever public agenda there is. And we were talking about the case of one state in which attainment is the single public agenda goal, and asked how do you get presidents on board for this, and basically you hire presidents who commit to be on board with this when they start. And I think maybe that's something that could apply also to board members. If the public agenda is clear enough in the very picking of people, in the very hiring of people, you can actually make sure the commitment is there before they even begin.
Britt, I know you will not be influenced by the fact your board chair is sitting on most of the
absolutely
front row,
not.
So just
no.
Say what's on your mind here.
Our conversation followed very closely the one Jim just described. We spent a lot of time talking about boards and discussed this thought that higher education has become such a complicated enterprise that the selection of board members takes on probably even a greater importance than in previous decades, and also the sensitivity to the need of array of talents that are needed on a board. I think we observe that the corporate sector does a much better job of going out and picking talent to fill particular needs of the corporate board, and we don't do that as well in higher education. This brought forth the idea of the AGB process, and we thought maybe that needs to be brought back on the table. Now, it may be that's going to be difficult to pull off in most of the states, but perhaps there's some modification of that so that there's at least some vetting of names before the governor makes decisions on board appointments. We spent a lot of time talking about the need for board assessment, and we feel that this is, at least our sense was, based on those in the room, that this is done perhaps not so systematically around the country, and that we thought that the board assessment, which ought to be an ongoing process done internally every year, periodically ought to have some third-party assessment, some third-party validation, some expert come in to take a look at what the board is doing and to provide some sense of its performance in a larger context. The idea was even put forth that you might want to couple this with the assessment of the CEO. That is, if there's some external assessment of the CEO, there might be some value in coupling that assessment with the assessment of the performance of the board. But in any case, some periodic third-party evaluation assessment of the board would be well taken. We did move to one other area other than the governing board when answering to how can state leaders and policymakers work together. We felt that these PK through 16 or PK through 20 councils that are growing up around the country have a lot of potentially a lot of value. They are, maybe I'm speaking more my own observation here, but that they need to somehow be connected to the governor's office, either the direct involvement of the governor or a representative of the governor, because so many of the issues that need to be addressed at the PK through 20, the only force that can ensure that there is the adequate kinds of collaboration is the governor. And if the governor, or at least isn't brought into that conversation, some of these gaps in our pipeline will continue to exist. We also thought that these councils, it would be helpful to ensure that they have a broad array of expertise that would somehow be linked to this agenda or plan that we've talked about in the first question, so that the secretary in the state who's responsible for economic development or workforce development perhaps should be part of this council, so that these issues impact the economic development of the state are at the table during these council discussions.
Darrell, you started us on number two. Anything you would add or
spark, just one quick thing, and it goes back to this issue of, I think, sustaining not only the enterprise but the connection to the public agenda, and that is that several friends indicated that the boards, in case what happens if the system breaks down, and Britt's point, the governor has other important agendas to work on, and we're not the top priority. So the issue of some institutional memory, and if everything works, to have as an explicit part of the board's recurring agenda, so that new people who come on board, new lay members, are aware of an ongoing set of issues, and the board itself, not just external actors, has an internal mechanism to re-educate, not reinvent, but to re-energize and invigorate itself, but from some foundation, some base of knowledge about from whence it's come. So I think that was an important issue.
Good. Comments, questions before we... I want to make one. Andrea, sparking off something you said, 10,000 board members, you said, of various... I know that's a number that's been swept together of lots of But that's a big number. And I may be idealizing what went on in Kentucky years ago, but there have been instances, and Gordon, I think maybe this happened in Virginia with the Council of Higher Education years ago. Didn't J. Harvey Wilkinson serve on the UVA board and then the State Council of Higher Education? This cross-pollination, you used to see it in Kentucky a lot. A person would serve on a regional board, and believe me, in Kentucky, the universities are regional for the most part, and then come to the State Higher Education Board, or even move between those institutions. And I think some of this cross-pollinization, and I guess a governor would have to do that, but with 10,000 folks floating out there, I think there's some possibilities there. Let's go to question three, and let's see. Peg, you're looking expectant. Why don't you start us here?
Just a couple of things. We also dealt with the question of cooperation with other state agencies. I should have mentioned this before. One of the ways a board can magnify its influence is to work in partnership with the key agencies with which it has common agenda. For instance, partnerships with commerce or partnerships with K-12 around sharing data particularly. We think it's very important for all of the work to be data informed, and that's something that often cannot be confined within a single sector. We also think it's very important to find ways to give credit to presidents who play in the public agenda as well. And the second point I would make is that one of the problems we've seen is that governors talk to each other, and when they become invested in a process, a lot of times what happens is that they will imitate each other when they hear a good idea, what seems like a good idea, and won't stop to find out whether or not it's actually an idea that works. In other words, there is really a real possibility of magnifying mischief as well as magnifying good practice. So we thought there should be some group that makes it their agenda to collect best practices. Again, getting back to the question of data, best practices as indicated by the kinds of results that come out of the work. So those were our two additions.
Very good.
Mark, I'd like to pick up on
yes,
that. Ron Kyle, 24-year veteran legislator, Susan Hegard, some of these same ideas, but that partnership really got talked about in our group. And in order to move the agenda forward in many of these areas, we're going to have to do much more of that than we've been accustomed to. With the public schools or with basic education, we've got to get that connection. That's our pipeline. We've got to find more ways to partner with the Department of Economic Development, whatever it's called in your state. Even the suggestion I think, Ron, you made, if you have that big nursing shortage, maybe you need the secretary or commissioner of health involved with you. Those partnerships are so important. But then what we really liked was some of Gordon's work in his paper, when you need to tie the money to it. And you need to have rewards to change the structure. If you need more nurses, there needs to be some money tied to it. There needs to be using this funding as leverage to get it done. And maybe on some of these partnerships, they don't get the money unless they're able to work together and get it done in more effective ways. Really tie money with it was important in our group. And then there was some suggestions, too, that on this policy change, that some ideas that came out of the papers and the speeches today that we picked up was that some think that we maybe need to wait more money toward serving the lower social economic levels of students who need more in order to get up to where they need to be. We need to maybe have some financing relationships in able to do that. There was also the feeling in the states that do have financial aid programs, and that's almost all of them, that we need to focus on the needs of maybe lower income and minority students and take a look at that, and this is one area where we need to work. And then it was mentioned that in such areas as science and engineering and some of those initiatives, STEM initiatives, there is a way to use policy and funding to make some things happen along that line. Thank you.
Good. Daryl?
Okay. I'll jump. Let me add to Jim just three points. One is really to just embellish or to compliment, and that is, I think, if I can generalize a little bit from our discussion, in our group, I think it seems intuitively obvious, but part of the term collaboration as well as partnership, I think we use both, came up, and that it's got to be seen not as a process, but as an outcome. Or we get bogged down in just process and talking about how do we collaborate, how do we build partnerships as opposed to doing it, and then being able to measure it and assess the good we've done. A rather perhaps radical idea that goes beyond what Jim reported is not only to partner with friends and colleagues in government and in business and elsewhere, but perhaps even, I think the verb we should merge, perhaps merge some traditional higher education functions, yet with other agencies or new entities, especially on issues related to say literacy and job creation, economic development, and so forth. A research would be a good example. Another point that came up that comes back to the first question was that the group felt that boards really have to own this partnership or collaborative agenda, that it can't be a cursory ad hoc type of a deal. But the boards really have to own it and understand explicitly the role of the institution or the system in sustaining, carrying out this statewide agenda. And finally, I think there was strong consensus that to be successful, we have to create forums to help inform ourselves, other actors, the governor, legislature, but citizens about the progress that we're making. That it can't be an inside our community. It gets to some things that Jim talked about and others. It just can't be inside our community. So we know what we're doing, and maybe our governor is lucky enough that he knows what or she knows what we're doing. But the broader public agenda isn't as well served because we haven't built them into this. So that forum, whether it's the SHIO or the system board or the governor's office in collaboration with others, I thought that was important. Build into the system that function from the beginning.
Terry, your comments about the partnership may, in fact, tie into something that Peg said a moment ago. She used a different term about agenda, a common agenda. You know, we work better together if we have a common something that's really pulling and bringing us together. Britt, what would
yes,
you say?
We had two thoughts that haven't been mentioned yet. Let me just quickly summarize them. One is that there was a feeling in our group that there needed to be considerable thought and attention and innovation given to the interface between K through 12 and higher education, and between K through 12 and the two-year schools and four-year schools, that there are huge leaks in our pipeline at these interfaces. And there needs to be some very serious thought and innovation given to these connecting points. Of course, some states are experimenting with what we call early college, where higher ed goes into the K through 12 sector to offer college courses to seniors in high school. We need to do more on dual enrollment between the K through 12 sector and the four-year sector, between two-year schools and four-year schools. And this will undoubtedly require, if we're going to be successful at this, some policy changes. That was really the question. I mean, for example, there are all sorts of funding issues. If a kid is taking, in the K through 12 sector is also taking a higher ed course, does the K through 12 sector get full funding for that student? Does higher education get credit for the enrollment? I mean, there are policy issues here that would have to be addressed, but that it is very important that we bring some new thinking to make this these points of transition much more seamless. One other topic that came up at the end of our discussion, it's not really a policy change, but something that we felt could be beneficial to moving the agenda forward, and that is finding appropriate ways for governing boards and the governor to have what we refer to as two-way conversations on an informal, ongoing basis. Obviously they would have to be carefully constructed, that needs to be a two-way conversation, but the idea that the governor appoints a governing board and then never has any more interaction with the governing board is probably not a good thing. And that finding a way to have this continuing regular dialogue would be healthy. I saw an example of that with our board. Our chairman arranged a lunch with the governor right after he came back from the National Governors Association meeting where the topic was higher ed. And we had an incredibly rich and engaged conversation. And I think it was no decisions made, no policies made, but it was a healthy thing to for both sides to sort of engage on around some really important topics. And we think that would be a good thing to just build into the way states operate.
Yeah, you know, and that's a that might be I could see that working. I was at the NGA meeting this year when Friedman and Jeffrey Immelt talked about energy, and I'm telling you, for a governor then to have moved to talk to leaders in the state the day after that would have been powerful. Yes, Jim.
Mark, I wanted to pick up something that happened during the day, and this is just a consideration for your evening, for your work session that's coming up, and that is the future importance of lifelong learning. And the idea that there might be a health account for people to continue, because I think we're in a society where all of us are going to need to be updating, going back to school and so on. That may be our biggest business as time goes on. And it just seems to me, both in policy and in terms of this public agenda, we need to pay more attention to that, because that's the only way we're going to stay nimble and change and continue to have our workforce be world-class competitive.
Good point. Are there comments, questions? Bob, you're near the microphone. Yes.
I'll just make a comment on the partnerships. We all know that collaboration and partnerships is labor intensive. It takes a lot of time to make it successful. Needs to be win-win. I would encourage us to look at our words that you pointed out earlier. Words create worlds. Our language, our labels are really crucial. P16, K16, we learned the hard way after a decade of work and trying to engage our business community. They don't see themselves in the label. They hear P, when they hear what it stands for, they don't see business in there. It's hard to change that label. It's been around for years. When we do our work with K-12, how you come up with inclusive language, so you say educators as opposed to teachers or faculty. That's just one example, but there are lots of examples that we tend to overlook and find ourselves turning people off. We don't even know we're doing it. We also tend to speak with jargon, and we find ourselves, when we're reaching out to partners, that we miss the boat completely. So I would encourage us to really look hard at the labels we use in the public agenda we're creating.
Good. Travis?
Just an observation, and this touches on, I think, all three of the questions in some respect and came around in our group about this idea, particularly on sustainability of an agenda. And it seems like, to me, it comes back to two things. It comes back to simplicity. We've had a lot of conversation today about the complexity of this enterprise, and I would be the first person to agree with that. But often in public agendas, we immediately go to some of the complexity and say, oh, we can't treat this institution this way because of their mission. We have to be sure to take care of this institutional type because of their mission. Perfectly legitimate. But then when we get down to that level, we never get back up. We're at 10,000 feet, we never get to 30,000 feet. So at some level, we do have to say it is about simplicity. It is about educational. This is a body count. I mean, this is what we're in now is a body count. And every type of institution has an ask and a give in that kind of an environment. And I think the other part is, as a correlate to that, is shared values. Find me a faculty member, find me a business leader, find me a governor that doesn't want more students to be throwing that cap at the end of the commencement ceremony. Find me one. There are some out there. I probably had a couple of those professors. But if we start from that which we agree on, then we have to get to the what we don't agree as much on, which is how we get there. But I've observed over the years that often we start immediately in a conversation about how we get there, and it immediately then devolves into, well, my institution shouldn't be doing that because that's not our mission, or our funding formula doesn't account for that sort of behavior. And it seems so deceptively pedestrian, but it starts from, what do we all agree on? Let's all agree that we want 55% or 60%. Korea has said they want 100% of their adult population to have post-secondary education. That's a hell of a gauntlet that just got thrown down on us. And in what ways can we really start at that level of simplicity, then start peeling the onion, get into those things where the waters will part at some level? But I think, you know, the ideas of simplicity and shared values seem so obvious that I think we walk right by them sometimes because we're really smart people. And we walk right by them, and we forget that there's a lot of people in our states that are right on those two pieces, those two points right there.
Very good. Senator?
Thank you. I think we could spend the whole day talking about how our higher ed institutions could advance a public agenda and contribute to the public good. And I don't think we've spent enough time on this, not just today, but in general, because we've been so focused on getting students through the pipeline and graduating and then assuming they go out and do good things for the public. But I just want to give you an example. And I think I'm a legislator, so I really like to see concrete examples. What are the best practices? And then I want to put them in legislation. There is a need in our state for dentists. We have a shortage of dentists in the urban area and in the rural area. And we all know the reimbursement rates are very low from Medicare and or Medicaid. And a state college identified that need in Chancellor McCormick's system and came up with the idea of an advanced dental hygienist degree, like a mid-level practitioner master's degree. And they brought their bill to the legislature to authorize licensing for this, and ran into incredible roadblocks from the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, right? Because if anyone was going to do it, they wanted to do it. But they didn't really want to do it because they saw it as competition with their dentists, even though there aren't enough dentists to serve the population. So this is an example of leadership from below, really. It was a college that came up with this idea, working with, I think, maybe some nonprofit advocacy group, and a lack of leadership from our flagship university, because they should have been at the forefront. They should have identified this problem and been at the forefront in trying to resolve the solution. So the only way this could really happen at the legislature was if I carried the bill in my omnibus bill, because the university couldn't kill it then because they'd piss me off too much. So we made it somewhat of a study, but the enabling language is there, ready to go, I think by the fall of 2009, we should be enrolling our first students in this mid-career program.
Very good. Governor, the last word on this session?
I'm not sure, but we're getting close to the end. I heard someone say and agreed with the need for the message to be one of simplicity and sustainability, and I agree with that. But whatever that message is, it must be marketed. And it seems to me higher education does not do a good job of marketing its message. If you look at educational organizations, for example, you have one for public colleges, one for private colleges or independent colleges. You have one for community colleges. You have SHIOs. You have a variety of organizations that represent some facet of higher education. Look at the governmental side. You have the National Governors Association and the regional groups, Southern Governors, Western Governors, Northeastern Governors. And then you have those organizations of aspiring governors, the National Association of Lieutenant Governors, National Association of Attorneys General, the National Conference of State Legislatures. It seems to me that if higher education could ever reach an agreement on a message of simplicity and sustainability and could market that message with some consistency over time, it could achieve some of these objectives that we've been discussing. But that's going to require all of these organizations, or a majority of them, to reach some consensus on an approach of working with all of these organizations on the governmental side. They all have education committees.
former presidents, existing presidents of institutions, legislative leaders who are recognized for their educational expertise in the legislative arena, are people who should be working closely at every meeting of these national and regional governmental side organizations. I don't see that happening. I see, and at least in my own experience, I have seen college presidents and organizations represented on occasion, but not consistently. And if you have a message that is not marketed, you will have a message that is not sold.
Okay. Well, one thing, if Mark gives me 30 seconds, I learned a long time ago, you don't one up the host, and the governor should have last word. However, just one little guy from one state that concurs, and so what we're doing in my state, New Jersey, is we've done over 7 years quite explicit scientific polling using the same not techniques but the same firm or firms that governors and chief executive officers, including the some of the people who would like to be our next president and other executives in other states, in other countries have used, such as Tony Blair. So we have that to find out, again, what not a priori what we think the public agenda is, but as governors, what is the public agenda? And the second thing we've done is, I took a phone call today to orally hire a vendor who's going to give us, the public colleges in New Jersey, for the first time, a system that, again, governors and other elected officials have used so that we can stay in touch with the publics and build support to stay on message, on the agenda the governor articulates a lot better than I can. And so that's what I think we have to be risk takers. And I'm not going to put words in your mouth, sir, but we have to take some risk and stop looking for other people to do it for us. And I think that I appreciate that. I will take that back to New Jersey and share it with 9 university presidents first thing in the morning. Thank you.
I liked your term earlier today, Darrell, when you talked about finding the public agenda and finding those points. And it may, we talk about state public agendas, so that implies there are more than one. We are at a point where, one, we are going, some of us are going to adjourn to the Scripps Library. And Michael, the Scripps Library is?
Far side of the building.
Just take a left and keep on going. You will be there. If you find someone listening to a secret White House tape, you know, don't disturb them. Don't disturb them. Governor Bliles is going to go to the council room along with Rick and Rich and Jim Dutterstadt and Gordon Davies, Paul Lingenfelder, Mike Mullen, and Greg Wegner. Did I get everyone's name? Everyone got the assignment? The council room, which is?
Halfway.
If you go to the Scripps Library, you've gone too far. Come back. And then we will reconvene in this room at 5:45. Okay? Thank you to a wonderful panel.